should I head over to H now?
Okay, I think I will start, and I'm hoping that this is also working, the sound. No? Okay, sorry for those at home. Yes. Men man bara check då att det är ljud. Ja. You maybe have to turn up the volume if it's too low. Okay. Originally, Jeff Ham is the one that has the lab in this course. He has been employed at the sheriff's office for, I think it was 11 years. However, he was working as a computer crime detective and forensics examiner. He has since been employed with Mandiant since 2010. Where he's also conducting forensics examinations and incident response. So, in part of because of this, he is in Germany at the moment, I think, for some incident there. So instead of canceling the lab this semester, I decided to hold it for you. So the lab was cancelled last semester, and I think that it was a bad idea. That you should be able to get the experience with we're working with for forensics tools. But keep in mind that this is not. That I don't have the same experience as Jeff Ham, but I will do my best. I was, as I said in the beginning of the course, I was a student that have done the lab before, so I hope I know the right answers. Yes, so we are using both the rooms. We are streaming for this from this room, but if more people are showing up, then they can use the other A255 room. And for our remote students, they can use a Blackboard Collaborate. Carl will be monitoring the excuse me. Yeah, so Carl will be monitoring the Blackboard room and forward questions to me. I have organized dinner for the Thursday, which will be pizza. So if you know that you are not going to be here on Thursday, please send me an email or something. And if you are going to be here, please also send me an email, because then I know I know how many is in this room, and I can order with that number in mind. Also, please inform me of any allergies, or if you are a vegetarian. So, you, after I have given my presentation, I will give you the exercises. And you are basically on your own. I'm here to help you, but you manage your own time. So if you need a break, then you can go for a break and work in your own pace. For questions on Blackboard, I think it's best if people raises their hand and send the question as a personal message to Carl, because then if there is a lot of the discussion on the Blackboard forum, then we will need to. But then it will be difficult to see the questions. I will also want to inform that the deadline for the paper presentation is the same for both local and remote students groups. So just keep that in mind. You have already been told where to find the necessary files. I have also uploaded today's presentations and today's lab exercises. I have only when I did this lab, I think it was I had Windows 7 or something. But this year I have tested on Windows 10 with Redline version 1.20. But I don't know. I haven't encountered any problems, so I don't think you should either. The same files can be found on Kepler, but I have heard that this server is slow. So I think it's better to download it from Blackboard. If you are interested in forensics, there is a Sans HIFT workstation that can be installed on Ubuntu. This will give you access to Many of the necessary files to conduct a forensics, a detailed digital forensics examination. FTK imager can be used to scan a hard drive for various information, and can also be used as a standalone disk imaging program. The red line is the program we should be using for the exercises. Most of the exercises, it is a live forensics tool, and I will get back to what I mean by live. Is the sound okay for you guys? So, the lab is over 4 days, and each day is a new set of exercises. So again, I will start the day with giving a presentation, and then you will be working on your task. As a side note, I want to tell you that I'm not going to, or we are not going to ask anything detailed about the lab on the exam, so I don't think listing out, for example, commands is very useful. Okay. So, taking notes is essential in any investigation. This includes citing commands that you run and anomalies that you have found. It is also very important to start working with a timeline as soon as possible. So Excel is a good tool for the timelining. It is a good tool because it have sort options and multiple tabs, so you can organize that timeline, your artifacts and notes. As the timelining tools have become more robust, they have also been used to cut down the amount of the data that forensics investigators have to look at. But now they are getting more data, and much of that data is usually noise. So a lot of the noise reduction, it takes experience and some pattern recognition. So over to the data collection. A forensics copy can be acquired through a live system or from a dead drive. And usually the forensic request is more about the process rather than how and what is acquired. Physical imaging will capture all of the ones and zeros of on the drive, one bit at a time. It will capture the deleted space on on the hard drive, even if the drive has been recently formatted. It will capture the deleted files, black space. So, physical imaging is usually the most preferred method because you get kind of everything. But then you will lack, for example, volatile data, for example, from main memory. So, logical imaging is an alternative. Where you get a copy of the contents of a volume as interpreted by the file system, as you're looking at, for example, Windows Explorer. So you use the operating system to collect the documents you need. So if there are any deleted files that is not in the recycle bin, then you will not get those from logical image. Yes, so the difference is a logical image is what you can access as you wear a normal computer as you were a normal user on that computer. But if you get access to the raw the physical disk, then you will have access to the entire file system. So, for example, in the FTK imager, as you can see here, you will have access to OS protected files, special metadata files, used by the operating system, and data in unallocated space. File systems also improves or changes as technology evolves. So each have a different way of storing files. So, for example, the famous FAT32 or the file allocation table changes the blocks of files together, while the directed table captures file hierarchy. And the NTFS represent each file on a volume by record in a special file called master file table, which I will get back to tomorrow, I think. Live or incident response have different objectives than digital forensics. In a business environment, you are more concerned with getting your system up and running, back to the normal state to then continue to earn money rather than maybe shutting down the system and then taking all of the information out. So, incident response, there is always a trade-off between: are you going to have to look at this system, or should you continue and maybe focus on a different area? Yes, so you might want to I collect the contents of memory first. So processes, network configurations, and connections. As those the data are destroyed when the memory loses power. On the other hand, you might want to shut down the computer to collect more non-volatile data. Evidence. Sometimes this will also enhance each other, so the volatile data can give you more context to the non-volatile evidence. But there is some key guidelines for acquiring live or doing a live imaging. So your goal is to use to make as few changes to the live system as possible. Everything you run on the system will make changes both to main memory, but it will also change the Windows registry. Other locations, but that cannot really be helped. So, I should avoid copying files to the system. So instead, using a USB drive, for example, connect to it, and also the results. Should be also copied back to the USB and not stored on the system. Then you have the last point is to document everything, so you can then show that you have done the. Which steps you took during the acquisition. Yes, so this is just to compare again. You can find out what is stored on a system via the live imaging that you will use the operating system or through a raw disk image. And you're only going to know which process are running if you're using a live image. I'm not a redline guy. As I said, redline is a free forensics tool from Mandiant, where Jeff is working. So he has more knowledge of Redline than me. But it is a live response toolkit that you can copy over to a USB drive and then log into the target system. and it will collect both volatile and non-volatile evidence, and it will output it on the same I do speed to drive. And then you can review the results via this Redline software. So Windows has some have a various different connection states, but pretty much they are they have the same functions as the TCP protocol, with, for example, syn sent, syn received. Or if they are listening here, then this socket for that process is listening for incoming connections. Or if they if it is established, then this there is some communication between you and the other. But in a local IP and a remote IP. So that these are the connections on this computer, we want to show you. We want to show you that you're missing some information that the red line will give you. For example, yeah, there's no good examples here, but I imagine if this is a calculator.exe, then you will not know if it's the real calc.exe that comes with Windows, or there's a Trojan horse, for example. So this is what Redline give you. It will give you the path to the executable, which is running instead of only the process name. A system can have multiple web browsers installed, and each have a different way to log history and personal setting for each user, and Mandiant's tool Mandians, the toolkit pulls also history record from Internet Explorer, Firefox, Chrome, and Safari for all users. Also users within the browser, but also users on the computer. So Windows Refresh, it stores data about the application you run on the system to help it start faster. And this can be useful artifacts for forensics. Useful artifacts for forensics investigators to then analyze which application has been run on the system. So, for example, if a suspect has been running CCleaner, for example, to cover up any potential evidence, then the EFetch file might still exist on the system even after the program has been deleted. So each EFetch is associated with the program name, but also the path. So different path will have a different hash at the end of this EFetch. We did not go into the specific details of this hash function, so I don't know anything particular about this one. Usually this is disabled on Windows servers, except for boot EFetch. So when a new application is started, it will only create a new EFetch file when the first time the application is started. So that this can help you determine then when a malicious program was run, and combining this with timeline analysis, you can then identify additional files that were downloaded or created on the system. It only captures the timestamp for when it was last run, but also the number of times this executable has been run. It also captures the first read and writes within the 10 first seconds of executions. And so here you will then find the additional malicious files. Yeah, we did not go. We did not go into the mechanics of how EFetch works, or some other fields like access file list. So over to the lab for today. It is Friday, and we are sorting through the endless feed of unresolved security alerts that have accumulated in your CEM dashboard over the past several days. Most of them are easily dismissed as false positive, resulting from misconfigured or overly sensitive rules. But upon a unique event catches your eye. And it's a... lots of suspicious request to the destination IP. So you have been then kind of using this Mandiant live response to the toolkit to generate a report, and you begin the analysis. So in the files that I gave you, you can either start a red line by pressing the red line session, or you can open up previous analysis. So you will mostly be using the analysis data on the left side here. Here you will have access to the registry. You will have overview of the processes and networks and the connections and things like that. You can also search the results and change the scope, which will be useful to then filter out the noise. I think I will have a small break here to make pictures on the blackboard behind me. So maybe it take 5-10 minutes. Okay, so I think we will start again. So, file systems, they are, you can think of a file systems as in the same way as you do for networking. There's layers of abstraction, and we will go through each one of them now. So you have the physical device. It's itself. There are differences in how you connect them. If they are a spinning disk or with flash storage. The disk can be partitioned into one or more partitions, where each partition takes up a space on the disk. So each partition can be formatted with a file system. So in this example, we have NTFS, FAT, and two unallocated. So, for example, from the Windows perspective, then you will be able to read with one partition as a volume. And that's the same with FAT, but the other two partitions is not a volume because the operating system cannot read it. If you had a, for example, a Mac operating system. Then they are also able to read all NTFS, FAT, and the HFS and plus. But still, the last partition is not a volume because Mac cannot read unallocated partitions because they cannot read the file system. So yeah, here are also some of the list of file systems. So. The thinking of a spinning harder disk. Each sector sector. Each sector on a hard disk is 512 bits. So this is the smallest unit for a hard drive, but the operating system cannot read over write to sectors. Operating system can add address blocks or clusters with sectors. So it depends on the setup, but usually the number of sectors is 8 in any modern operating system. So a file will be stored in these clusters. Up until a certain point. So, for example, this file.txt only uses about 2/3 of this allocated space for the file. And each kind of cluster can be stored either in one continuous line, or it can be fragmented, that parts of the file is stored at different places or at addresses in the file system. So, for the file system, you have metadata, and that is data about data. So, a file system usually have dates for when the file was created, modified, and so forth. I will come back to this on the next slide, but you can also have for example, NTFS have access control list. A file can take up less than the numbers of sectors it was allocated. So the file.txt was allocated one clusters, but it didn't use all the sectors. So the file size for them, this file is the physical size is 4 kilobytes, because it uses all because it has been allocated this one sector. But the logical size is only the content, so about 2/3 of this cluster. The difference between these two is known as slack space. I have heard that you can kind of store or hide information there, because the operating system knows that the logical size is this much, but you can then store or hide information here. So in short, often the physical size is larger than the logical size, but it can also be equal to. If it's larger, then there's usually an error. In Unix, we have something called MAC times, and it refers to the the timestamp of the latest modification, M time, access the time, and change the time, and the change is then for the metadata and not the content of that file. So when you, for example, change the file owner of file access control permissions, then the metadata is changed. On the Windows system, the C stands for created, but in the equivalent for the Unix system is birth, but that, yeah, that doesn't really exist. So sometimes the difference will cause incorrect presentation of the time in metadata when the file was created on a Windows system, but accessed on a Unix system, and vice versa. On MS-DOS, you had you were allocated file names for MS-DOS had eight characters for a file name with and plus B for the extension. So to have a backward compatibility, Windows NTFS has something called a short name or an alias. So that is when the file name is longer, it will sometimes also store the short name also in the metadata. So to wrap up something, the sector is the smallest decibel unit for a hard drive, while clusters or blocks is a group with the sectors and is the smallest decibel unit for the operating system. Clusters can be stored continuous, or they can be fragmented. Allocated files are those that have not been deleted, and they are visible for the end user. When housing the file system, the deleted files are those who are removed by the user, so they are unlinked by not showing up on the under the directory. But the metadata and the data units or the clusters in are only marked as free or available for a new file. So this can be covered with special tools. Orphanet files are similar to those that has been deleted. But the link between the metadata and the file is no longer accessible. It is still possible to recover the metadata or the file, but there is no correlation between the two. So for unallocated files, this it has also been unlinked and or reused by another file, but you can still but you can still recover some parts of it. Not the same with overwritten. No, I mean. Yeah, the same with overwritten. For example, the data units has been reused by another file, but if the previous file that was occupying these clusters, you are still able to retrieve the data in the slack space. So the process of recovering these files is then known as file carving. Are there any questions before you start on the exercises? No. You will find the exercises on the blackboard under the lab folder, same with this presentation. Yeah, I forgot to say something, but that there is nothing planned after the exercises. So if you are finished early, then there is no one holding you back here. Okay, so I was just asked to show where the ports were. Okay, there we go. I was asked for some remote students to show you where the ports were. And so you look at the left side of here. Then you can find the ports. And the first question is, do any processes have connection to the destination IP seen in the network alert? We can try to search for the IP address, and no matches found. So the IP address for the first question is the same that was from the first kind of alert that you got from the incident.
Ah, there we go. It looks like we have overloaded the Whois tool from our IP address block, so you might be getting some kind of message saying that you cannot do any more queries. Google Whois and find an alternative IP map to find out Whois besides using Whois.